everyone. This is Yannick Silver from InternetLifestyle.com and MaverickBusinessAdventures.com. And with me, I got one of my friends, Tim Barrist, who I'm really excited to bring back and interview again. We haven't done a formal interview in I guess a couple years now since he released the 4-hour work week, which just went on to obviously become an amazing, successful phenomenon. The guy is, just everywhere. Nominated as one of Fast Company's most innovative business people, angel investor in some of the really mainstream websites like StumbleUpon, Dig, Twitter. I said he's the author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Wall Street Journal, and Business Week bestseller, 4-Hour Work Week. It has now been sold in 35 different languages. He's, all over the place. I just opened up Wire Magazine a couple weeks ago. He's in there. Tim is just one of those really amazing, inspirational guys that is doing so many different things from helping out and having a big impact with the thing he does with Lit Liberation and Donor Shoes to just really being involved in a lot of different internet activities, and as well as crazy ass experiments and things that we're going to get to, because it's a little bit OCD. So Tim, you there?
Just a little.
Yeah. Bit. all right. So this is fun because you and I met a couple years ago, like right before, maybe it was like a year and a half before 4-Hour Work Week came out, and we both were big fans of Dan Kennedy, and I reached out to you, and we kind of realized that we share a little bit of that same wild DNA together of really wanting to live life and experience everything. And you've done all sorts of crazy stuff. So I'm gonna actually kind of take us from 4-Hour Work Week and then move over to your new 4-Hour Body, which has some wild stuff in there too. But since 4-Hour Work Week came out, I mean that was kind of one of those things that, I don't know, it was on the tip of almost everyone's tongue. It made a massive splash from not only people who were just kind of wanting to get something up and going online or live an incredible lifestyle, but to just major institutions like Google and so forth, where you've provided speeches there. What did you learn? What's like some updates, or maybe how has your philosophy changed on the 4-Hour Work Week since you put that out there?
The philosophy, the basic tenets haven't changed much. There are a few different mental frameworks that I think are very powerful that were not emphasized strongly enough in the 4-Hour Work Week. I take principle among those, having had the chance to spend time with some incredible entrepreneurs and CEOs and billionaires and the whole nine yards, as have you, of course, but really trying to model these people and look at their best practices. What you realize is that time does the value of income. That's very true. So that's talking about the different currencies involved. And so you can have a bank account with $100 million in it, but if you're working every hour that you're awake, it could be argued that money is worth nothing, or that income is worth nothing. But the one step further that I've come to realize is that attention determines the value of your time and your income. So take, for instance, someone who decides on a Saturday because they haven't planned their weekend activities, non-work activities, decides to check email for 10 minutes when they wake up. And they get up, they have time to check email for 10 minutes. This is true, okay? But if they check email for 10 minutes and they find a problem they can't address until Monday morning, now they don't have control of their attention for the next 2 days because they'll be preoccupied about that problem that they need to face on Monday morning. And what that means is the next 48 hours are rendered useless. They're not productive. They're not relaxing. And that, I think, is one of the variables that you can really focus on and formulate in a typical question, and that is not asking yourself, can I spend this time, or do I have time for this, but do I have attention for this? And perhaps the best way to phrase it is, can I afford the interruption? Okay, so do you have time to stop what you're doing, make a phone call to check on an item on your credit card statement? Sure, you do. But if that means you're interrupting one of your milestone tasks and it's going to take you another 30 minutes to get restarted and back in the zone to work on that task, can you afford that interruption? probably not. It's actually probably a very bad decision to interrupt yourself with that task. So that is something that I've seen across the board with the top performers, the high percentage of the top performers that I've modeled and spent time with, that I think could be emphasized to great effect for most people.
Now, do they bracket out time and say, okay, between, you know, I'll put 30 minutes on Tuesdays and Thursdays and I'll check email only, or is it more kind of haphazard? Where's the focus?
Sure. It depends on the person. There are different ways that they implement that. There are some people, Governor Schwarzenegger is well known for this. He actually does very little calendaring. He will not put things in his schedule that could end up becoming interruptions. And if anything is not one of his primary priorities, it's uncalendared. It's kind of catch me when you can catch me, and if you catch me, great. If not, you'll just have to keep on trying, and we'll see if we can make it happen. That is actually fairly common among some of the highest level CEOs that I've met, which was very surprising to me. I thought that it would be very meticulously planned and they would have a very set schedule according to their priorities, but it ended up being quite the opposite in some cases. There are other people who will very clearly say, I'm on a meeting blackout or a meeting diet for the next 2 months. So people are like, hey, you want to grab a lunch? Could you do a conference call? Could you do a meeting? Sorry, I'm just doing no meetings for the next 2 months. And they just patently reject, politely, every single offer to meet, to do a conference call, to do anything like that. Everything that gets to them has to be very precise with an ask and an email. And that's another way that they avoid interruption. And another approach that I've seen that's very curious is many of these people, and this is something I've been doing for a while now, will, instead of saying, here's my day, and in the beginning of the day, I'll take care of email, and then I'll take care of responses to this type of customer, and then I'll block out 2 hours to work on my most important task, as opposed to taking that type of approach, they break down the week. So they'll say, Monday is my administrative paperwork minutia day, where I deal with the things that I need to handle that aren't critically important, but they do need to be done. And then Tuesday is my focus day, where I have no meetings, no phone calls. All I do is focus on my to-dos. And then Wednesday is whatever it might be. And then let's say Friday is meeting and socialize day. So Friday would be the people that you want to meet with simply to maintain a social connection. And there is value there. Let's just say Friday is that day. So you might go and have wine early at 4:30 with someone who's who represents an important relationship, but you block out that day for that purpose. And I think that can also be extremely effective in multiplying your output and impact.
And which of these productivity hacks have you taken on?
The last one I mentioned, I've actually incorporated all of them. So if I'm doing no meetings and things like that, a slightly less severe version of that would be, hey, I'm not doing any in-person meetings just because I can't afford it right now. But, you know, if you want to try to catch me, I'm not calendaring any phone calls because I'm already over-calendared. But, you know, just try me anytime after, like, 6 p.m. a week from now. And if you catch me, awesome, I'm happy to talk. And what you find, you'll notice one thing I added in there, and that was, don't try me tomorrow. It's try me in a week. And
yeah.
Particularly if it's not that important to you, it's more important to the other side than it is to you, and it's not one of your highest priorities. If someone doesn't follow up with you in a week because they don't have the discipline to do that, it's a bad idea to become involved with them in a business capacity, a partnership capacity, or anything else, because it's only going to ultimately cause headaches. So I like to delay the follow-up that way. And what you find is 90% of the people never, ever follow up, which saves you the trouble and the ultimate headache of engaging with that person. And then the blocking out of specific days is also something that I found very, very effective. And in fact, what I said, the Monday as administrative, going over websites, looking at blogs, how do I tweak, how do I optimize this, this, and this, little things that need to get done that I like to have a hand in, that aren't necessarily the most important multiplier. Like one of the next things I'd like to do is write a screenplay. And when I start that, that's going to be my priority. So tweaking my blog is not going to be the most important, but it would be something that I would do on a Monday. And then Tuesday would be completely dedicated to the screenplay, let's just say.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. And then Friday might be meeting up with financiers involved with funding independent films. And perhaps it's the producer of Thank You for Smoking, who's a tech entrepreneur. And
right.
things like that. Or just simply friends. I don't think there's anything wrong with batching your interactions with friends. Because it's not impersonal. You're just making you're making time for your friends in a way that respects everyone's time. And I think that people appreciate that if they have the same set of values and mindset that you do.
Yeah, that's great. There's a couple quick things I want to follow up on, and then definitely want to get into this new behemoth, massive book that you got. You mentioned two things. One, you talked about your blog, tweaking your blog. You have probably, I don't know where it lies right now. It's definitely one of the most popular blogs out there. You've you just done an amazing job at making it a destination for people to hit. You have any tips there for doing that?
Absolutely. Blog has been one huge experiment for me, and it's been very fun, sometimes frustrating, always insightful to receive the amount of feedback, immediate feedback that I do. So it's very easy to test different things. So the blog, just to answer your question, where is it? It's about 1,600 on Alexa in the U.S., so that means it's in the top 2,000 or 1,500 most popular sites in the U.S., which for a single author blog is pretty good. There are a lot of blogs that get more traffic that have 6, 10, 20 writers, but in terms of single author blogs, especially a blog that posts once a week or once every 4 weeks sometimes, it's fairly unusual. And so about 1 million uniques a month to the blog, sometimes more, sometimes a little less. And the way that I've accomplished that, I feel the most important tenet is that I try to create content that will be as interesting and or useful to read 2 years from now, 3 years from now, as it is the day that I write it. And what that means is that you can then use tools like StumbleUpon and other types of reputation-based social tools to increase the traffic over time, where you get to a point and you have not just one post that's popular for 2 or 3 days, but you have, let's just say, 100 posts that are popular every month, and that snowballs very quickly. So really focusing on every content, I'd say, is the most important factor. And if you have any other specific questions related to commenting, rules of engagement with commenters, things like that, I'd be happy to talk about that as well.
One thing I know you do really well, Tim, is the headlines and the titles for the blogs.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you test those things, or where do you come up with that you think that those are going to be your big winners?
That's a very good question. So there are a few different ways. The first is I try not to reinvent the wheel. A very simple thing you can do is go to a blog they do post very frequently, like Seth Godin's blog, and look at the number of retweets. So you can go to Seth Godin's blog, and you can see at a glance 20 different posts and how many retweets there were. And the dirty little secret of Twitter retweets is that I would say at least half of the people who retweet don't read the content. They just base the retweet off of the headline, based off the tweet. So you can see what works and what doesn't. And you'll find that good bloggers, much like good copywriters, tend to have a number of templates or formulas that have proven effective that they use and tweak over time. So there's no need to start from scratch and reinvent the wheel. That's number one. Number two is I do use a tool called Super, SU.PR. That's the website. It's run by StumbleUpon. I'm an advisor to StumbleUpon and help them to develop this product, which allows you to post to Twitter and Facebook and perhaps a few others and look at the response that you get. So it tells you what time of day is the best time to post, what day of the week, But you can also look at how much click-through, how many click-throughs you get, organic traffic you get through StumbleUpon in addition to, which has 10 million plus users now, in addition to the Twitter traffic. And one of the things that I'll actually do, this is a little trick that you might like, is I'll put out a tweet at, let's say, 12 midnight or 11 p.m. Pacific Standard, so most people on the East Coast are asleep. I'll put that out, and I'll see what the response is in the first 2 hours or so. And then what I'll do is I will use a different headline, and using Super, I'll schedule it to be tweeted the next morning at like 7 a.m. Eastern Standard or 8 a.m. Eastern Standard. And what I'll do to change the URL, because if you use the same URL, this is true with Bitly as well, if you use this exact same URL, it's just going to use the same link, the same short link, and you won't have any useful data because it'll just be one. And the way you change that is after the URL, you put a question mark equals, I just put test one, you can put anything after it, but question mark equals, and then whatever, and that does not interfere with the click-through. Obviously, test it before you tweet it out, but that will then be turned into a different short link. So now different links, and you're effectively doing split testing, and it doesn't cost you a dime. So that's a very cheap MacGyver approach to getting some fairly decent data about which headlines are working and which aren't.
Yeah, no, that's a good one. I mean, I know you spend a lot of time just crafting. I mean, almost every blog post is just, it's one of those that you want to read and obviously spread the word about. And that's, I think you've done an amazing job really building that up. Well, let's go ahead and just change gears here into the 4-hour body, because that is the massive book that you've been working on for quite a number of years with all these crazy experiments. How long has it been? 2 years?
3 years. 3 years of actual writing and a decade of gathering data. So that's a lot. It's been a lot. This is the culmination of, God, it's like my life's work, this thing. It's hard to believe how much time has gone into this. But I'm happy with it. But like you said, it's quite a big cookbook.
It's an interesting, it's one of those that you can just flip through and find something fascinating, something that can help you. When you and I were first, I think you were throwing out some titles and you said, how to make yourself superhuman. And, I'm like, oh, that's a great title. And, that's really what this is all about. This is all about either rapid fat loss, gaining more muscle, even incredible sex, becoming superhuman. But so let's, some things that jumped out at me. One was 4 ways to make failure impossible, and it's almost counterintuitive, some of those.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of it is really around for entrepreneurs. I mean, if it's like if we don't have our health, we really don't have anything going on. And it sounds trite, but it's true. So I know many entrepreneurs, business owners I talk to, interact with. Literally just today, I was with my one of my forum groups that I meet with, and I'd say 3 or 4 out of the 5 of them were talking about, hey, I'd really like to, God, I'd like to lose some weight here, I'd like to do this, and it's been a common theme. So what are some of those things that, that are those counterintuitive ways to get, to not fail on these things that we want to do?
I will jump right into that because I think that's the most important part of the book, and that's why the first 40 pages or so are dedicated to failure-proofing whichever program you choose. I want to answer one common question first because I know that it's perhaps the most common question, and that is why the hell I went from work and productivity and management and so forth to the physical body, because it seems like a complete disconnect. So I want to explain that really quickly, and then I'll jump into that.
Okay.
The answer is my obsession with physical tracking predates anything related to business by at least a decade. So I've been tracking almost every workout since age 18, and I've wanted to write this book for far longer than the 4-hour work week. But I wanted to wait until I had access to the best scientists, best doctors, best athletes, coaches in the world, and I do mean in the world, before writing the book. And the 4-hour work week was the tool that I used to get access to those people and their resources. So then I set out to do all the experiments and to do experiments on other people and really just say, I've tried all these 1,000 things. Here are the 3 that I was able to use that produced obscenely disproportionate results with not just me, but men and women of these various age groups. Like, these are the 3 things that you should try for these various things. So that just explains the background. But to relate it to your point and entrepreneurs, just very quickly, you may have noticed in the introduction to the book, there's an anecdote about Richard Branson, the billionaire founder of Virgin, the Virgin Empire. And he was part of a mastermind on Necker Island, his private island, and one of the entrepreneurs, you may have even been there for all I know.
I was there, sir.
There you go. So how do you improve your productivity, or how do you become most productive? And Branson's response was, work out. And he said, I get 3 to 4 hours of more productive time per day by working out. And the body, improving the body, meaning how your body functions as a physical machine, is easily the fastest way to improve your mental and cognitive performance. And we can go into that later, because I've measured all of this stuff. But for those who don't even care about losing fat, don't care about going to the gym, just to increase revenue or increase productivity, from a business standpoint, it makes very, very clear sense. Okay, so to jump into the failure proofing, a few things right off the bat. So the first is making it conscious, making whatever your current state is conscious and clear. So I did an analysis of the most successful winners of transformation challenges over the last 10 years, including Body for Life. Their diets were different in some cases. Their workouts were different. The one most consistent piece was they had before and after photographs that they kept in front of them somewhere that they would visit frequently on a daily basis. So people would take before and after photographs, and believe me, no matter how good you think you look, before photographs, or just photographs in general, pretty unflattering, right? So take these photographs, and many of these people would put them on the refrigerator. You don't have to do that, but use them as motivation and as a reminder of why you're changing your behavior. Right? That was the most consistent factor. So make it conscious. You really need to be aware of your current state. Secondly, is to make it competitive. And it's very simple to do this. So one of my friends who's in the book, he lost, I don't know what it was, 50 pounds, and a very smart guy, works at Google, makes a very good living. I mean, I'm sure it's in the 6 figures. And he decided with a friend that they would pay each other each $1 if they missed a workout. And so they plan to go to the gym, let's just say 3 days a week, and if one person missed the workout, they would pay the other $1. So this is an amount of money that makes absolutely no difference to either of these people, but the psychological response to that was that he ended up losing 50 pounds and went from never having run a mile since high school to finishing marathons. And it wasn't because his training was necessarily the best. It wasn't because his diet was necessarily the best. It's because he used that psychological setup. So you want to make it competitive, and you want to make it a game of some type. And then I would say lastly, and I'm skipping around a bit, but lastly it would be you have to track things, okay? And track sounds very labor-intensive. It doesn't have to be labor-intensive. So I'll give you one example. Food logs are very common. So people track what they eat, and then they write down the calories and quantify everything. And that can be consuming. It doesn't have to be, but it can be very time consuming. And what researchers have found to be more effective is just taking a photograph of your meals before you eat. Taking a photograph of whatever you're going to eat. So like whatever you're thinking about eating, take a photograph. And these days, it's very simple. You use an iPhone, you use whatever's in your pocket, probably. And what you find is by taking that pause and becoming aware of the decision you are about to make, people begin to make better decisions. They don't need any fancy dietary advice. They don't need a new fad exercise regimen from the hottest trainer. All they need is to take photographs of their food, and they start changing their behavior, and they lose 20 pounds in a matter of 1 or 2 months without actively trying to adopt any new behavior. So the bedrock with all of these changes, whether you want to run 5 miles, 50 miles, 100 miles, or put 5 pounds of muscle on, or 40 pounds of muscle on, or lose 40 pounds of fat, or 100 pounds of fat, it doesn't matter. These principles are exactly the same. And that is the portion of the book that's focused on failure proofing, and all of these things can be applied to business. Single one of them applies to business. And the examples in the book, there are a lot of examples from business. You might have noticed this. For example, there's something called the Hawthorne effect, and this is named after a company, Hawthorne, that conducted a number of studies, I think it was in the 1950s, where they wanted to see the effect of increasing light, increasing the brightness of light on factory workers. So they increased the light in the factory, and lo and behold, the workers were more productive. Oh my God, that's quite an important finding. You know, increase the light, they work more. Amazing. And then somebody else in the same group decided, you know what, let's just try something else. And so they dimmed the lighting back to the original setting, and they worked even harder. And then they decreased the lighting, and they worked even harder. And what ended up being the case is that the workers knew they were being tracked, so they worked harder. It had nothing to do with the actual brightness of the light. And what that means is tracking doesn't need to be difficult. All it means is that you're recording something so that you're aware of it. And that could be as simple as using a withing scale, which is it's a scale that sends your weight to the internet, and so you can see a graph of it. And doing that every morning, and measuring your weight alone is not the best way to do things. I offer a lot of better alternatives. But just by doing that every morning and then looking at a graph, your behavior will change. And there's another case study in the book of someone who did exactly that. All he did is weigh himself every morning and look at it in a graph, and he lost 30 pounds over 6 to 12 months, and his goal was not to change his behavior. He wanted to do it in the laziest way possible. So those would be a few examples, but they're all applicable to business.
What's your take on that as far as a mind-body kind of thing, just where your attention goes is where you see results?
Oh, absolutely. They're integrally related, and I like to talk about the brain and the body, because people think of mind as something separate from the body, and I think that's where we get into a lot of trouble, because, like I was saying before, the body influences the brain, or the rest of the body, and the brain certainly influences the rest of the body. It's the central governor. It's the headquarters, so to speak. But you can see some incredible results. For example, if you take two groups and you have one group perform strength training twice a week, and you have the other group simply visualize doing the exact same strength training twice a week, you'll oftentimes find, and this is in the literature, it's very clear, that the group that visualizes still improves their strength like 25 to 50% as much as the group that's actually going into the gym. This is with no exercise whatsoever. So there are very easy ways, very small steps that you can take to achieve some pretty amazing outcomes. I mean, my dad, as one example, I mean, he was 250 roughly at 5'6", and I helped him lose 90 pounds of fat approximately and gain 20 to 25 pounds of muscle. He's 65, 66 years old. And this was done with tiny steps. Nothing, at no point did it seem like an inconvenience or imposition to his lifestyle at all. And it was just amazing to watch the transformation over time, because when you take very small steps, like removing milk from your coffee, all right, so this is one thing I observed, because I tracked hundreds of people trying these things, so I got to see the patterns. And that's where the business background was very helpful, able to spot the patterns. And what I noticed is that when people removed even the dairy from their morning coffee and replaced it with, let's just say, some cinnamon and vanilla extract, which is delicious, by the way, that they could lose an additional 2 to 5 pounds per week. Okay, that's a very significant amount of weight, and it's a very meaningful amount of weight for somebody who's, let's say, has 30 pounds to lose. Roughly 10 pounds for most people. If you lose 10 pounds of fat, that's going to be a size, like a shirt size. You'll go from an XL to an L, or an L to a medium. And it's those small changes that add up really, really quickly.
losing interest. No, I totally agree. The little things. You know, what's really interesting to me is just this fact of measuring. And it's like after college, very typical, probably athletic in college, still athletic, but I've probably gained, I don't know, maybe like a pound, 2 pounds, 3 pounds every year, just not really paying much attention. And all of a sudden, I was like looking at the scale. I'm like 179, and I'm about 5'8". And I'm like, God damn, that's pretty heavy. And simply by paying attention and weighing myself then every single day and changing just a little bit of my diet, eating leaner, not drinking every single night, and I dropped like about 15 pounds. And it's really true. Just those little changes really add up. Let's talk about something really maybe somewhat controversial, Tim, and that's the polyphasic sleep, which is maybe like one of those things that people are maybe have heard about, haven't heard about, which is the notion that we can get less sleep, not be tired, and achieve superhuman results and productivity that way. Myth, fact, is that possible?
So the polyphasic sleep is possible, but actually since the book was finished, I've been looking at some really interesting data related to this. So polyphasic sleep, there are a number of forms of polyphasic sleep. All that means is you're breaking up your usual single block of a target 8 hours, let's say, into multiple sessions of sleep during the day. And the more you break it up, the less total sleep you need. So there are people who follow, for example, the Uberman schedule, which is about 2 to 2.5 hours of sleep a day. And I do know people who've sustained on this. There's a lot of controversy about it. But the goal of the book is to really show people what's possible, including what's possible at the extremes. And you don't have to go to the extreme level, of course. But it's incredible what the human body can do in a very short period of time if you track your data and just pick out a few patterns. So in my particular case, as one more example, I am a career wrestler. I was an All-American in high school, but I've always had relatively weak hands, and I wanted to get better at a movement called the deadlift, which is you have a barbell on the ground that's just loaded with plates, and you pick it up off the ground to a standing position. That's it. And I could barely do 300 pounds, which sounds like a lot, but for someone with the amount of wrestling background, it's not that much, for one or two reps. And just a few weeks ago, I did 630 pounds with rack pulls without any straps, my hands, just my hands alone, no assistance whatsoever, with no weight belt for 3 reps. And that type of progress is not unusual if you train correctly. And you don't have to get to that point, but people assume many things are genetically fixed where they're very much genetically pliable.
And sleep is one of those.
And sleep is one of those, absolutely. So now what I would say, just as a caveat, is that if you feel like you need to only sleep 2 hours a day to get more done, you should probably focus on some of the time management, priority management points that we talked about earlier. That would be my first stop before you decide that you're going to take 8 naps a day and go to 2 hours of total sleep. I think it would probably make sense. Even if just from a social standpoint, it's pretty hard to have a girlfriend or a boyfriend or a wife, much less a wife or family if you're taking 8 20-minute naps a day. pretty socially inconvenient. But I would say focus on, obviously, the time management first, but showing that it's just possible. That it is possible, for example, like I did. I was trained to hold my breath by David Blaine, the magician and illusionist, and went from 45-second maximum to 3 minutes and 33 seconds with one evening of training. And that means that I broke Harry Houdini's lifetime record by 3 seconds. It's absolutely unbelievable. Now, do you want to learn how to hold your breath? No. But is it a fun chapter and reads like a diary of a madman? Absolutely. It's a pretty amusing read. But for most people, just losing, let's say, recomposing their body by 20 pounds, so let's just say that's it's very seldom just about losing fat. And for that reason, I included a photograph of Marilyn Monroe doing bench presses in the beginning of the book. It was a very hard photograph to get to use because you really need the muscle for any type of functional living, and certainly for the best appearance. So for most people, it's going to be, let's just say they weigh more than 120 pounds, it's probably going to be 20 pounds of recomposition. So that might mean losing 15 pounds of fat, gaining 5 pounds of muscle. I think for most people, losing 10, gaining 10 again, fat muscle, or gaining 20 pounds of muscle. For some guys who are particularly small and have no problem with fat, their problem is they can't gain any muscular size. That's something that most people can achieve in the span of 4 weeks. I know that sounds ridiculous, but you saw in the book itself, I was able to gain 34 pounds of muscle in 4 weeks with 2 30-minute workouts a week. I'm not saying that's average. It's most definitely not average. But again, showing you what's possible at the extremes so that whatever your goal is doesn't seem even remotely impossible is really one of the objectives of the book.
Yeah. Well, talk about the, you've done, I don't know how many experiments are inside this book and how many you've personally done, but what do you think has been the most impactful one for you, or just has really, amazed you with what's happened?
The most personally impactful, I would say, was actually the swimming. I was unable to swim more than a lap or two in a pool until roughly a year ago. This is very recent, a year, year and a half ago. And I was born premature. I can only use a portion of my left lung. I have no buoyancy. And it was always one of my biggest humiliations and embarrassments. I went to the beach with friends, and everybody would be out swimming around, playing around. I couldn't do it, wouldn't do it. And let's swim out to the buoy. Sorry, man. No way. Let's sit down on the beach. It was always really one of my deepest insecurities. And sure. I assumed that it was done. I assumed there's nothing to be done about it because I tried to take lessons. I tried to fix it. And the first thing people would do is they'd say, here's a kickboard. Go kick and do 4 laps. And I would kick and I wouldn't even move. And I'd do that for about 10 minutes and say, look, dude, sorry, I'm done. I can't do this. It's too humiliating. And
I would never have laughed at you.
Well,
I would have laughed my ass at you. I would have made you feel really bad about it.
So, yeah, I mean, understandably, it looks ridiculous. And in the span of 1 week, with a couple of tips from an Ironman triathlete and then being introduced to a very unusual type of swimming, or uncommon way of swimming, I was able to go from 2 laps in a pool to comfortably doing 40 laps in the span of about 10 days. And it was all from rethinking all of my assumptions about swimming. Like the idea that you have to kick harder to swim, no. This method, which is based on Kerry Laughlin's work, is using absolutely, almost practically, no kicking, and it focuses on rotating a streamlined left, streamlined right positioning. It's the closest thing to moving meditation I've ever experienced, and my speed is improved, everything's improved. So now I can go to the ocean, I can do an open water 1 mile swim, no problem, as a way to relax, which is inconceivable to me. Even now, I can't believe that it was that simple once I tested the assumptions. And for me, overcoming an insecurity of 20 plus years is part of the reason that I really knew this book had to be written, because I'd overcome so many limitations in work, and for whatever reason, I just hadn't applied all of that same work, all those same principles, I hadn't applied it to the physical body. And so I was like, okay, I'm like working 4 hours a week. Sure, I can do that. No problem. I was like, swimming in a pool for 5 laps? You're crazy. That's ridiculous. And realizing that the same principles apply and I could do the same deconstruction is what triggered at least half of what's in the book. So I would say that was the most impactful for me.
That's almost, it's been a bit of a pattern, I think, with you, is you take stuff from, not at face value. And you look at it a little bit differently. Like even the even that program that you did, I forget what it is, I think on the History Channel, where you were doing that crazy ass horseback
summit, right?
Right. Which is just completely wild. And you just have a different take when you step back and look at stuff. And is it by walk through a little bit of that thinking. Is it simply just saying, okay, well, if everyone is doing it this way, that means it's probably wrong, or how do you approach something when you're trying to essentially hack it, I guess?
Yeah, there are a couple of ways to approach it, and I think that this is something I've always been very curious, but I didn't have a method until pretty recently. And for this book, my method had to become much more refined than with the 4-hour work week. The way I approach things now is I look for the exceptions. I look for the people who are good at something that shouldn't be good at what they're good at. So to give you an example, I hate running. I hate it almost as much as I used to hate swimming. I really hate running. And so, of course, I decide, well, I need to get over that, so I want to run an ultramarathon. You know, I want to run 50 miles just to punish myself for being so big-headed.
And you need to go do Badwater, like one of my friends for the city.
There's no way. Okay, for those of you who don't know what Badwater is, 135-mile race through Death Valley. I will pass on that one. Yeah, people routinely pass out and have to be put in ice baths, and oh, no thank you. If you don't run on the white stripes at Badwater, your shoes melt on the pavement. You don't want to do it. So 50 miles for me, for most people, pretty ambitious, especially if you've never run more than 5 miles in your life.
No, absolutely.
So what I look for, where do I start? Where do I deconstruct that? So I will talk to the best people in the world, okay? And those people are probably going to be 6'2", 220 pounds. That's not an exaggeration. They are built for running. They're built for dissipating heat. And they have a lot to offer. Guys like Scott Jurek, amazing. I interviewed Scott for this. He's a 7-time Western States. It's a 100-mile race. He's like a 7-time consecutive winner of that race. But I also wanted to find people like one of the coaches I ended up finding, who was 190 pounds, about 5'11", ripped, could do squats with well over 300 pounds for reps, and trained, instead of the normal 30 hours a week, was training less than 6 hours a week, and still running 100-mile races. So how does that work? I first try to find those exceptions, and it's pretty easy, because I'll talk to someone like Scott, and I'll say, who doesn't fit the mold? Who are the people who look like linebackers who are running 100 miles? Because I want to talk to those guys too. It's very easy to figure out who they are, because generally there aren't that many of them, and they're looked at like freaks of nature. And what you find is, yes, some of them are freaks of nature, and then other people have just figured something out. They've stumbled upon something that really works that no one else believes works. And from that point on, I'll talk to both sides, okay, so that the people who are the best in the world, who are almost always going to be very well-designed for their sport, like Michael Phelps in swimming. But I'll ask them, okay, what are the most common beginner mistakes? Where do novices waste the most time? What is most commonly taught that you think is incorrect? Where do people plateau and why? What is something very counterintuitive that you've found to be most effective, whether it relates to diet, training, sleep, recovery, or something else? Who do you think I should talk to? Who else should I have coach me? And these are all the types of questions that I'll ask. And within 2 days of doing this, and you can do this online as well. Don't get me wrong. You don't always need access to the best in the world. You could go on a site like Quora, Q-U-O-R-A, and ask some of these questions and probably get very, very good responses that are quite accurate. And after 48 hours of doing this, you are so far ahead of most people who have been doing it in some cases for 5, 10, 15 years. It's almost unbelievable. Because rather than looking for what the most people are using, you're looking for the exceptions. You're looking for the oddities, and that's where you really find a lot of the breakthroughs.
Wow, that right there was really powerful, because I didn't tell you at Covert Ops that the Maverick trip that you went on with us. I have this notion of doing skeleton in the 2014 Olympics.
Wow!
So that just that gave me a great little game plan to figure out where the weirdos and the freak shows are that are doing really well in the skeleton that could somehow propel me in there. So that's pretty good.
Oh, absolutely. And another recommendation would be, don't seek out the people who are the best in the world right now, because they are in the limelight, they're going to be busy. They'll certainly have a high opinion of themselves, and rightfully so, but it means they'll be less responsive, and because they're still competing, there's a good chance they won't disclose the secret sauce.
Yeah.
Find someone who's no longer competing, who hopefully has done some coaching, so they figured out what's unique to them that they can't teach, and what's replicable, and you find those people. And a very easy way to do that, of course, would be to go to Wikipedia and search for your event, and then just determine who the top three or four people are in the last four or five Olympics, let's say, and find someone who's just limelight, probably missing the limelight, and would love a little bit of exposure, certainly in your particular case, because you can offer them a platform. And, man, you have somebody who's going to be very willing to make you a guinea pig to prove that what they know works. And that would be another recommendation.
That's pretty good. All right, one last one, and then I want to wrap up and give people a special offer here. One of the chapters you got is about living forever, which you know, gives me a little chuckle. But it's you know, one of those things where how familiar are you with Dan Sullivan?
I am familiar with Strategic Coach. I've spoken with him, but I if we're talking about the same guy, maybe if you're in listening.
Yeah, same guy.
I don't know his position on this, though.
One of the things Dan Sullivan's also a mentor of mine, and I, you know, one of the things he talks about is extending the lifetime extender and extending your, you know, figuring out when everybody kind of knows when they're going to die, but extending out your lifetime and then with the things that you really want to do. But this is like scientific proven stuff on how we can actually extend our life. And you got any quick points on that? Because obviously, you know, everyone wants to keep it going as long as we're mentally sharp and physically fit and still enjoying what we're doing here.
Yeah, for sure. So the living forever is a bit of an inside joke, as indicated by the beginning of the chapter, because I think a lot of people make decisions based on extending their life without thinking about their quality of life. So you have people who look like concentration camp prisoners. This is no exaggeration, because they're subjecting themselves to extreme caloric restriction because they believe that will make them live until they're 120. Meanwhile, they're miserable, their hair is falling out, they have no testosterone or sex drive. And I view that as a Faustian bargain. I don't view that as a good investment. The things that you can do, and I've looked at this very closely, and a lot of people don't realize, I'm actually a faculty member at Singularity University, which was founded by Peter Diamandis, chairman of the X Prize, and Ray Kurzweil, who's very well-known, inventor, technologist, but well-known for his predictions related to life extension. And that's based at NASA Ames Research Center. And I've looked at this very, very closely. So a few things that people can do, I'll just blast off a couple of suggestions. The first is give blood regularly. These are whole blood donations. Don't have time to go into it hugely, but the directors of many of the centenarian studies, I think it's a proper word, people who live over 100 years of age, the people who research that group give blood regularly. That is one of the core beliefs related to life extension. Okay, so giving blood regularly, this is also, I believe, one of the reasons that women tend to live longer than men, and that is that they menstruate. We won't go into a deep dive on that, but give blood regularly. Give blood regularly, meaning like every 3 to 4 months. Second thing would be protect your brain, okay? So the regenerative medicine is amazing. I mean, I just came back from TEDMed where they had a living set of lungs, these are TIG lungs, inside a chamber that they had breathing without an attached pig, okay? The technology is such that you can currently print on a 3D printer portions of organs to be used in transplants. So what this means is, it doesn't mean go out and do tequila shots until your liver falls apart, but it does mean that your liver, your lungs, et cetera, if over time they degrade, you may be able to replace those or at least improve them, repair them in the next 20 years. I think that's actually very likely. The brain is not that easy. So you want to, the greatest extent possible, postpone or minimize anything like Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease. One of the easiest ways to do that, really surprising, one of the easiest ways to do that is to supplement with creatine monohydrate, which is a sports supplement. It was designed for improving power output. And if you supplement with, let's say, 5 grams a day of creatine monohydrate, and which is nothing, it's just drop some white powder into some water and you're done. It's been shown as very promising treatment for all of the conditions that I just mentioned. And it also, as a side note, increases IQ in people who are strict vegetarians. Pretty amusing, because creatine is commonly found in meat products, red meat in particular. So you can be deficient in creatine. But that is extremely cheap. You can get a month's supply of creatine for $20, $20, $30. And giving blood doesn't cost you anything. That's free. And so there are a number of approaches like that that I think done intelligently could very easily, and I know this is a strong statement, but I think it could very easily extend your lifespan by 10% or so. And that's a meaningful 10%. So, and not only extend your lifespan, extend your functional lifespan, okay? And this is an important point. I don't want to live to be 190 sitting in a chair staring at a wall. I want to be walking around. I want to be active. I want to be hiking. I want to be very sharp cognitively. And to do that, you need to protect the brain. And addressing iron, buildup of iron, toxic byproducts of iron, things like that are a part of that. So there's some very simple things that you can do that, based on the literature, based on the research, show very strong indications of extending lifespan. If you want to get super aggressive about it, there are other riskier things you could do. You could take immunosuppressant drugs like rapamycin, and there are people doing that. Do I recommend you do that? Absolutely not. It's very hard to predict what the long-term side effects are systemically of doing that. But I talk about all these, and I say, look, here are the risky but extreme approaches. Here are the approaches that I'm taking. And it just so happens that all the approaches I'm taking are very low-tech, very low-cost, and very low-risk. And so I opt for that group.
Great. All right. Well, the book again is called The 4-Hour Body, and it is available at wherever fine books are sold or not so fine books. And I'm sure it's going to be pretty much everywhere at the bookstores, of course, online at your major booksellers. And it's just like I said, it's just this massive. A reference guide, and you can always flip to anywhere in here, and it's going to be something that's going to improve your life. It's 500 some pages of whatever you want to do with your life, whether it's lose pounds, whether it's gain muscle, whether it's how to increase your sleep, how to increase your productivity, how to triple your testosterone and double your sperm count if you're a guy, how to reverse permanent injuries, which is really fascinating. And you got a lot of stuff in here. You have a special deal that you're going to do for people that are listening to this, right?
I do indeed. So the book was longer than it now appears in print. For cost reasons, and we can talk about publishing another day over a few drinks, but for cost reasons, about 100 pages had to be cut from the book, which might be a good thing, since it's big enough already. But many of those chapters are really interesting, including stuff like genetics testing. So how do you take a genetics test for $100, let's say, and figure out which supplements are actually going to work for you or which are a waste of money, and which will have the most impact or the best worth your investment. That is something that I looked at quite closely and pretty directly sparked an article recently in Nature magazine, pretty cool, and that didn't make it in the book. Another chapter is about spot reduction. So is it possible to use topical creams to reduce fat, let's say, in hard-to-reduce areas, like the abdomen for men and women, and for the legs and thighs for women? Amazingly, I expected it to be a total myth, and there were one or two products that ended up working. So Imagine that. That didn't make it into the book either. So there were a couple of examples like this. And if people would like to buy three copies of the book, so you know, one for themselves, two for Christmas gifts or gifts to other people, gifts to clients, whatever, I'm happy to send them one of the lost chapters. I haven't figured out which one I'm going to send because I want to make sure it's the most actionable, concrete one of these chapters. But if people buy three copies on Amazon and then send an Amazon receipt for three books to Yannick at 4hourbody.com, just all spelled out, Y-A-N-I-K at 4hourbody, F-O-U-R.com, 4hourbody.com, then I'm happy to send them one of the lost chapters. And that's something that you're certainly not gonna find anywhere at this point, anywhere. So I thought that could be fun for people who are interested. And last but not least, if you're not in the financial position to get the book at all, I still have a sample chapter on 4hourbody.com and a pretty cool video trailer as well. And people can go to the blog from there and find a lot of free content to learn from if they'd like to get a taste of things as well.
Yeah, well, they should definitely go there and read the blogs. You got some amazing material there, but don't be cheapskates. Buy at least one copy of the book. If not multiple copies, your friends, your family, anyone you care about will thank you for it. It's I was talking it up today to the guys who are very high level entrepreneurs who we're all talking about the same stuff about how do we make ourselves better, and it's a constant conversation, and it's something that can have a tremendous impact. So it's a great book out there. I give it my endorsement for sure. I'd recommend you guys pick it up. It's one of those that you just flip through it anywhere and you're like, wow, that's really cool, and you just find all sorts of cool shit in there. All right, Tim, I appreciate it. I know you got to run. So thanks for spending the time with us here. So once again, just send out that buy three books, don't be a cheapskate, or buy more than three books from the people you really care about, and just send the receipt to Yannick, Y-A-N-I-K at 4hourbody.com. And my vote is for that supplement chapter. That sounds really intriguing.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. So I'm hoping to have one of the top geneticists in the senior scientists in the country add a little summary to the end of that. So it should be pretty hot. Easily the most important thing this ever written, in my opinion. So hopefully people will enjoy it. It's a pretty fun read, A Diary of a Madman. And thanks for having me, Yannick. Always fun.
Yeah, my pleasure.